live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's daily coronavirus briefing.
In every corner of the Commonwealth, doctors, nurses, and medical workers have been stepping up on our behalf in unprecedented ways over the past few weeks. At the same time, the organizations that employ these folks have had their operating models totally disrupted by both COVID-19 and also many of the decisions and the orders that we've issued to make sure that we are properly prepared for the surge. The result for many of our healthcare provider organizations has been a huge hit to their operations and to their cash flow. To make sure these organizations can continue to operate and continue to meet the astronomical demands that we are placing on them, we plan to invest $800 million into the Commonwealth's healthcare providers. This funding will support hospitals, nursing facilities, primary care providers, behavioral health providers, and long-term service providers, and supports for other providers impacted by COVID-19 and the health emergency and many of the declarations, orders, and decisions that we've made and issued. More than $400 million will be allocated to hospitals, more than $80 million will go to nursing facilities, and more than $300 million will be allocated to other healthcare providers that are delivering medical care or providing services that keep residents safe in their homes and out of the hospitals. It will be distributed starting this month, April, through July. We were able to pull this critical funding together largely through offsets by reductions in MassHealth and enhanced federal revenue. And we want to thank our colleagues in the legislature who we engaged in a discussion with this prior to making this announcement and going forward with this proposal. The funding comes in addition to the $290 million in immediate cash relief and $550 million in accelerated payments to providers that we announced earlier in March. As we continue to navigate these unprecedented times, our administration will keep doing whatever we can to support the healthcare workers who are keeping us all safe. With respect to testing, as you know, we've been working aggressively to expand capacity here in the Commonwealth and are continuing to ramp up our efforts. Massachusetts is now one of the largest and most expansive testers in the country, and testing is going to be a huge part of how we develop strategies to deal with this virus going forward. We're incredibly grateful to the public and private labs and healthcare partners that have allowed us to dramatically increase our testing capacity and our output. In addition to the state lab, there are now 25 public and private labs testing in Massachusetts. As of yesterday, 76,429 patients have been tested, with nearly 4,500 new tests reported in the previous 24 hours. We're making a lot of progress, but we also know there's much more to do. This weekend, Lieutenant Governor Polito and I visited a new drive-through testing facility for first responders at Patriots Place in Foxborough. As we continue to talk to our partners at the local level across the state, we're going to continue to add more of these in all parts of Massachusetts. And earlier today, in partnership with CVS, we announced a new rapid testing site in Lowell, which will enable on-the-spot testing and results at no cost. The new CVS site in Lowell will use the new Abbott ID Now test and anticipates being able to test 1,000 people per day and receive the results on-site within minutes. People will be able to know if they're positive for coronavirus and take action immediately to seek the proper treatment. Positive cases will be connected to our contact tracing program, who will be on site, which we announced last Friday. And multiple language assistance will also be made available. These tests are available for all residents who qualify based on the CVS website's questionnaire, and more information is available at cvs.com. The new test site is well stocked with personal protective equipment, and we're hopeful to have enough supplies right now to get them through at least the next 2 weeks of testing. And we're grateful to the folks over at CVS for getting this up and running and supporting our efforts to expand testing capacity. As we work to isolate positive cases and prevent further spread, we know there's no population at greater risk than seniors, especially the ones who live in congregate care and long-term care facilities. There are roughly 1,000 such facilities in the Commonwealth, so this is a hugely important part of our response to the pandemic. Through the command center, The Commonwealth has taken several steps to support congregate care and long-term care facilities. The COVID-19 Command Center has been doing several things to help these facilities prepare as best they can before infection started spreading, and doing everything we can now to help these facilities deal with outbreaks. Should an outbreak occur, the Department of Public Health assigns an epidemiologist and nurses to support the staff who are working directly with the residents at each facility. Today, the Department of Public Health has issued enhanced guidelines to protect the health of residents and healthcare workers and to reduce the transmission of COVID-19 spread both inside and outside of these facilities. We've also significantly expanded our ability to rapid test at each of these facilities. One of the most important things we can do is test this population quickly to identify positive cases and take appropriate action, such as isolation or treatment. Over the past several days, Massachusetts has launched a robust testing program for our seniors to do on-site tests at our nursing homes. It's not only a faster way to test, but it also prevents seniors who may be fragile or ill for other reasons from being disrupted or having to be brought to a hospital or an outside healthcare facility. The testing is being conducted by trained personnel from the Mass National Guard in partnership with DPH and the Broad Institute. These samples are then prioritized for processing. So far, the National Guard has been deployed to 80 facilities across the state and has completed more than 1,350 tests since this program started 7 days ago. Today, they will visit an additional 20 facilities. And we'll continue to build testing capacity in the coming weeks to serve a greater population and support many of our most vulnerable residents. Secretary Sutter will have more to say about this in a second. I want to remind people today, tomorrow, the day after, to stay home and to continue to take the necessary precautions associated with social distancing and following the guidelines that have been issued to keep each other, and especially our most vulnerable members of our community, safe and healthy at this time. We're extremely grateful for everything everyone has done to help us mitigate the spread of this virus in what has been, we would all agree, an incredibly difficult and trying time. The coming weeks will be crucial in fighting this disease and especially dealing with the surge, and we want to thank you for all you're doing to help us and to help your friends and your neighbors and your families. Residents can continue to stay informed by visiting mass.gov/COVID-19, which has been newly redesigned based on feedback from the public to help users find more quickly the information that they're looking for and that they need. And I do want to say thanks to the folks at the Executive Office of Technology and Security Services for their work with the Department of Public Health and our office to launch this redesigned site. It's part of our commitment to making sure that we get important information to the public in real time. And of course, you can always call 211 with questions or text COVIDMA to 888-777 to subscribe to text alert updates, which are now serving hundreds of thousands of people here in the Commonwealth. And with that, I will turn it over to Secretary Sutters.
Thank you, Governor, Lieutenant Governor. Good afternoon. As the Governor noted, we're infusing $800 million in critical stabilization funding to support our health care providers, particularly ones who are impacted by and responding to the COVID-19 public health emergency. As the Governor noted, and as we would all know, health care providers who have stepped up in unprecedented ways the past few weeks while experiencing significant impact on their revenue and operations. Funding will support hospitals, nursing facilities, primary care providers, behavioral health providers, and certain long-term services and support providers. And the funding will be distributed starting this month through July. The majority of funding, $400 million, supports 28 safety net and high Medicaid hospitals to address lost revenue, to stabilize them, and increase costs for hospitals at the front lines of treating patients with COVID-19. Included is a 20% rate increase for COVID-19 care, as well as a 7.5% increase across the board increase for all other hospital treatment. More than $80 million for nursing facilities, $50 million is dedicated funding for all nursing facilities across the state, essentially a rate increase. And facilities and units within nursing facilities that become designated COVID-19 sites of care receive approximately $30 million in additional funding to support their ability to care for COVID-19 patients. $30 million is for other healthcare providers delivering medical care for COVID-19 or providing services that keep residents safe in their homes and out of hospital, including $50 million for community health centers, $30 million for personal care attendants, funding for ambulance providers, community behavioral health providers, and home health agencies, and then funding for certain long-term care services and support day programs, such as adult day health and dayhab programs that have essentially converted from group programs to actively serving members via alternative means. And we've asked the Executive Office of Health and Human Services, sort of funny to describe myself in the third person, to continue to evaluate the situation and report back to us in June. As the governor said, we have put out additional guidance for nursing homes. Yesterday, we launched a nursing home family resource line, a dedicated telephone line that will connect family members of nursing home and rest home residents with information and resources that they need. The resource was created so family and community members have one central contact that they can reach out to if they have questions or concerns about the care their loved one is receiving during this COVID-19 pandemic. It is staffed 7 days a week. Staff coordinate across all state agencies to help callers find answers to their questions. That number is highly publicized, but for today, let me just give it to you. It's 617-660-5399. PPP update. Finally, as we work to ensure all our healthcare workers on the front lines are protected and safe, we continue to chase more PPE to get out to healthcare facilities, cities, towns, and our first responders across Massachusetts. Since the outbreak started, we've been able to get over 1,000 deliveries out. Over the weekend, we made around 350 deliveries, including 340,000 aircraft, as we refer to them, N95 masks. And to date, almost 475,000 masks so far have been delivered. We also delivered 95 of the 100 ventilators that we received from the federal stockpile. The PPE has gone to nursing homes, senior living facilities, hospitals, community health centers, local public safety, boards of health, and other healthcare facilities in the Commonwealth. We'll keep working to ensure we're bringing every resource we have to bear in the fight against COVID-19. Governor?
Questions?
Say again.
Were you on the call with Vice President Pence and Pena yesterday?
Yes.
Did you learn anything more about the distribution network for COVID-19 personal protective equipment?
Anything more than I already knew? No, I wouldn't say that I did, but they've been pretty good about communicating with states between those calls. Most of the communication typically takes place between FEMA and DC, FEMA at the regional level, and then the MEMA folks in the command center here. But there's a lot of traffic back and forth between the federal government and state governments on almost all the issues associated with PPE. Yeah.
Any more ventilators coming?
At this point in time, they and we are spending a lot of time tracking ICU bed use and ventilator use and access to ventilators, not just here in Massachusetts, but all over the country. It's one of the things that there's literally daily traffic back and forth between states and the feds. We fully expect that they will be amenable to providing us with additional units, particularly as we get closer to the surge.
This is WBUR, and you're listening to live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's daily coronavirus briefing.
Well, we asked for somewhere between 1,000 and 1,700, depending upon how you do the math and how you think about it in terms of what our anticipated and projected use would be. But as I've said many times over the course of the past 2 weeks, because this is an unprecedented circumstance, people are trying to learn from their own experience and from the experience of others as they go, because no one knows exactly how this is going to play out state to state. And if you pay attention to a lot of the models that are out there, they're constantly being revised by real data as the date that you expected something to happen arrives and something different is actually going on at that moment. And that's not just true here, that's true across a lot of the states. We're going to continue to advocate for additional ventilators because we believe we need them. And that's a big part of what the back and forth between the state and the federal government has been about for the past few days. But I'll give you two examples of what I mean by this. State of Washington sent 400 ventilators to New York. The reason they sent 400 ventilators to New York was because they had 400 ventilators it turned out that they didn't need. Oregon sent 140 back to the stockpile. I think over the course of time, what you're going to see is a fair amount of back and forth between states and the federal government, and just between states themselves with respect to access to those products as people need them to deal with the surge, because the surge is not going to happen at the same time in all 50 states. Quite the opposite. It's probably going to happen in clumps depending upon where particular outbreaks are occurring and where particular hotspots are. Most of the manufacturers of ventilators have presence in the U.S., although some of them do a fair amount of their manufacturing work in other countries. We're currently chasing a variety of supply chain channels that way as well.
Governor, could I ask you about unemployment benefits? You had mentioned last week that independent contractors, gig workers, part-time employees shouldn't file yet because you're waiting for the go-ahead from the Fed. Are we any closer to that?
The answer to that is yes. We've gotten there are three things that have happened on this. The first is we have talked to many of the financial custodians that we deal with on the traditional program and believe we have a workable plan in place to send unemployment benefits to about 240,000 people who've applied under the traditional program with the $600 additional payment, and those payments are going to go out over the course of the next week or so. In addition to that, we've gotten some guidance from the feds about how they're thinking about the gig workers, the folks who aren't currently in the UI system, who don't have a W-2, basically have 1099s, and that has made it easier for us to start thinking about how we would stand that up, but there's additional guidance we're waiting for and that we need to actually be able to implement the program.
Are you hopeful this week?
Oh, yeah, I'm really, yes. I would like to have it this week. We would like to get enough. Look, we spent a bunch of time trying to figure out how we would actually get money out the door, given the difficulty associated with a population that we've talked about here doesn't actually have a footprint within the existing UI system. And I think we've come up with some ways that we can do that. But they need to be done in conjunction with and in compliance with whatever we get from the feds.
Can you break down where the $800 million is coming from? You said from the federal?
It's a combination of things. First of all, you all may recall that we basically told the healthcare community that does elective surgeries to stop because we wanted them to build out capacity for COVID-19, and that is exactly what they've been doing. And as a result, there's been a pretty significant drop in payments made for those kinds of activities. In addition to that, we have a slightly higher reimbursement rate coming from the federal government under the second stimulus program, which added a 6.25% additional reimbursement rate at the federal level. You put those two things together plus a couple of other things, and that makes up a big piece of how the math works. And I would just say two things on this. You know, for those of you who remember the Democratic National Convention that took place here, I'm going to say 10 years, 15 years ago now?
04, right?
Was it 04? Okay, 15 years ago. Almost no health care got delivered in Boston during that period. And the reason I know that is because I was at Harvard Pilgrim at the time, and Harvard Pilgrim, Blue Cross, Tufts, and the provider community all noticed that literally everything went away during that week. And some of it came back and a bunch of it didn't. The second thing I would point to that we had similar circumstances with was a weather-related event, which was the winter of 2015. I mean, basically, nobody went to the hospital for a month in February during that period. And if that lasts for, you know, a certain period of time and then you expect things to start again, then the provider community can basically manage its way through that. But when you have a situation like this one, where we ordered them to stop doing elective surgeries, and where people stopped going in many cases unless they needed to go pretty much anywhere because we've got orders in place and essential workforce requirements and all the rest, that dramatically reduced our spending and their revenue. And at the same time, we were saying to them, we need you to build out capacity to meet the demands associated with COVID-19, which they're doing. We're basically almost going to double our ICU capacity as a result of that activity. But there's no money coming in the door for that. And we want to make sure these people and their workforces are properly prepared clinically, but we also want them to be in decent shape financially. And the secretary worked with other folks on the team in our administration. We then spent some time with the legislature, see if they'd be okay with what we were proposing to do here. And as a result, it's basically a big investment in our healthcare system based on some of the savings that came about as a result of decisions we made, the increase in the federal match money. But it's designed to make sure that these folks are financially able to stand up all the stuff we need them to stand up as part of the surge.
Is it a supplemental budget?
This is Radio Boston. We're bringing you live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's daily coronavirus briefing from the State House.
Part of the appropriations we're working with.
Any update on
Governor, I'm
the testing?
Looking at some guidance that was sent to employees at the Holdup Soldiers Hall about when they get their test results. And it says if you have a positive test but it's showing no symptoms, you should report to work. Is that how you
speak to this?
COVID test results action chart.
Can't say I've seen that chart. So let me give you some updates. I need my glasses. Let me give you some updates on Chelsea and Holyoke. So the total numbers at Chelsea Soldiers Home in terms of deaths hasn't changed. So we have 5 veteran resident deaths. And at Holyoke Soldiers Home, the total number at the Holyoke Soldiers Home in terms of deaths also has not changed. It remains at 25 veteran residents. We've increased the number of clinical staff, in particular social work and nursing staff, in order to have more contact with families, in order to ensure the families get the information that they need. We have been testing all of the staff, and I actually can't comment on what you're asking me because I have not seen that document, but I'm happy to sort of take a look and get back to you.
Should anybody who tests positive, should they report to work if they are showing those symptoms?
So the guidance generally is if you test positive, that you should stay out of work for a period of time, and then if you're asymptomatic, you can come back to work with protective gear and masks and the like. So I would need to see that document.
Secretary, could I ask you a question to follow up
sure.
on that? You've run some statistics about nursing homes. And I've been looking at parts of the state where deaths have gone up, and it looks like nursing homes are where there's clusters of deaths, and that distorts the numbers a bit. Do you have numbers on how many deaths are at nursing homes in these older facilities?
So that's a great question. So one of the things we are doing a deeper dive on is sort of the regional percentages of death per capita and looking at sort of where nursing homes are and other clusters, Bruce, because actually if you look in the Berkshires, of course, is where we had the first community spread, which was in Berkshire County up by in Pittsfield, and so that also sort of contributes to that. So while I can't answer your question specifically today, we're actually sort of doing a deep dive looking at where nursing homes are, where deaths have occurred by counties and the like, so that we can actually sort of pinpoint what is it in that region That contributes to sort of a higher per capita death because it's right now it's Essex County, Berkshire's in particular, have higher percentages of death rates.
Any updates on the testing sites that were talked about yesterday, particularly the Big E?
So I wasn't here yesterday for the press avail, but the Big E, so today, as you know, the Lowell site opened, and I just want to, if I can, just expand a little bit on what the governor said about the Lowell site. There's two things that make the Lowell site different. One is that it's rapid testing. So when you go and get tested, you will be asked to sort of step aside, and about 15 minutes later, you will get your test result. We also have the Partners in Health tracers at Lowell, and so if you were then positive, a Partners in Health contact tracer will approach you and talk to you about what you need to do to self-isolate. So it's like we're trying to bring together testing, like rapid testing, and then if you test positive with one of the Partners in Health contact tracers, giving you information, and it's in the five primary languages that serve the Lowell community. The other thing is, and maybe it's just we're all into data these days, so one of the questions someone asked when we rolled out the Partners in Health contact tracing program, someone asked, you know, is anybody going to apply for it? Over the weekend, there were more than 5,000 applications for the contact tracing program. 2,500 of them have been screened in for interviews and the like. So I'm not worried about having enough contact tracers in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Governor, I know yesterday...
I'm sorry? So we tried to when testing sites that we're involved in, we try to put that information out as much as possible. And let me just, so going back to the Big E, so the Big E should open up by the end of the week. Sorry about that, didn't finish that question. So obviously people can open testing sites that we don't know about, right, in the physician's office and the like. What we're trying to do is ensure that we have spread across the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. We're trying to reopen another site in Shrewsbury that closed, which was the CVS site with FEMA. Lowell just opened, so the Northeast has not had a lot of trace, and we actually have a map that can show where we have testing sites. I mean, obviously, our goal is to have as accessible testing as available for people in the Commonwealth, and we will be expanding mobile testing, particularly for people, as the governor said, who are, for whatever reasons, right, mobility is an issue, and having mobile testing is very important to augment sort of on-site testing capacity in our state.
Do you anticipate releasing demographic information about all these cases that come in, and are you expecting a disproportionate impact on communities like Chelsea, Revere, and Ogden?
So, you know, I won't speculate, but yes, we are trying to take as much data as we have available to put it out. One of the challenges with testing data is when it comes into the lab, a lot of the detail that we would want, such as ethnicity, race, is often left blank, and all you get is the person's name and date of birth. So we're trying very hard to like get all of those fields filled out so that we have robust data available to report to the Commonwealth. But we are going to start putting out data, even though it will be incomplete, so that we can just get the data out, and with all the caveats that it's incomplete and the like, so that we have a better sense in Massachusetts.
Governor, could I ask you about the flattening of the curve? Yesterday at Eastern Bank, you warned against looking at just a couple of days and taking too much stock in it. And yet, although we haven't seen the stats from today yet, is there a concern that with the weather getting nicer and people thinking that things are getting better, that we may give up on social distancing and things could go south quickly?
Certainly one of the reasons we made the decision we made to ban parking at state-operated beaches was because we didn't like what we saw going on there with respect to distancing and gathering generally. I know that's one of the reasons why the mayor made several of the decisions he made with respect to parks in Boston. And many of the other local officials that we've talked to have pursued a variety of initiatives in their communities based on that as well. Look, I absolutely believe that that as the weather gets nicer, we're going to have to continue to be pretty aggressive about our messaging on this stuff, because nicer weather will encourage people to go outside. And as we've said before, if somebody wants to go for a walk, no one has a problem with that. It's when it gets way beyond that, outdoor recreational gaming of one type or another, big groups converging on each other, road races. We can't have that stuff. We just can't, because it completely defeats the whole point of what we're trying to achieve here, which is to limit the virus's ability to jump from infected people to uninfected people. And I've talked before about the fact that we all have, about the fact that there is a significant number of people who are going to be, in fact, COVID positive, who are never going to show signs. And therefore, they are perfectly able to infect other people without ever believing or understanding or knowing that they have COVID-19 themselves. And that's one of the reasons why the CDC issued the order that it, or the guidance that they issued with respect to wearing a mask when you're outside if you don't think you can live up to the guidelines associated with social distancing, partly to protect you from others, but just as much to protect others from you. So I think the arrival of nicer weather is absolutely going to be an issue. But, you know, frankly, if we're going to be successful in dealing with this issue over time, and especially dealing with this issue as we head into the surge, people have got to understand that we need to stop the spread. It's like goal number one, job number one, and it has a lot to do with virtually all of the decisions we've made and the vast majority of the decisions that other states and municipalities and the feds have made.
Have you seen the numbers from today yet? And it, is there, in fact, a reduction in the increase?
I don't think they come out for another 50 minutes, right? We don't see them until...
I just thought you'd have an inside scoop, Governor.
Can I say one thing about the distribution of testing? The thing to remember here is every testing site is not necessarily ours. And in fact, there are many people who test in provider organizations all over the Commonwealth who rely on other labs to process their tests. Quest probably processes tests for dozens and dozens and dozens of providers that operate all over Massachusetts. We certainly believe that for our stuff, where we have the opportunity to put testing in places where, based on our conversations with folks in the healthcare community and our conversations with folks in the municipal community, people say we think we need additional test capacity. But remember here, there are a ton of providers out there who do not actually do tests on site, process tests on site, but who are actually doing tests on site all over Massachusetts. We certainly believe that in all of those programs, we're going to see increased demand, and expect and anticipate that that's something we'll have to work through our colleagues with the legislature with toward the end of the year. It's also part of where I think some of the resources that the federal government's made available to states will ultimately get applied. In the third stimulus bill, there are three big pieces to that one. One was the business relief, the second was the unemployment piece, and one of the other sort of major elements of that was support for state and local governments. And I fully expect that some of that is going to end up being used to support the increases in a number of those programs as well.
Governor, what is Dr. Burrell doing, and also Secretary Turco?
So Secretary Turco is, I'd say they're both doing fine. I mean, obviously there are different points in different places with respect to the virus, but they are both reachable by phone, and Dr. Burrell, I would say, is more reachable at this point than Secretary Turco. We've both told Secretary Turco to look after himself for a few days here.
Governor, on the news that a market basket worker died this morning, what is the spread looking like among frontline workers at pharmacies and supermarkets like that? And do they need more protective gear, or is
Well, we put out some additional guidelines for grocery stores today, which I don't know all of it, so I'm going to ask someone who does to speak to that.
We will be issuing later today the guidance, further guidance relative to grocery stores, so there's more of a uniform distribution across our communities about how to provide a safe environment for customers as well as the workforce at our groceries. We are issuing guidance that will say 40% of the occupancy, and that occupancy will include both employees and customers as the number to be enforced by local boards of health relative to the number of people in store to be able to access the goods and the necessities they need for their trip to the groceries and then to return home.
And are you all tracking how fast the spread is among those types of frontline workers?
I don't think we have a specific. We have our tracking numbers that you see as well as we do to examine, but to identify a particular working class of person or job, no, we don't have specific numbers there.
Thanks, everybody.
I certainly think that this should help stabilize healthcare organizations generally, and that was a big part of the reason why we did it. Yeah.
Thank you.
Welcome to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we've been bringing you live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's daily briefing on the coronavirus. A number of headlines today, mostly focused on $800 million in new funding for healthcare and healthcare providers in the Commonwealth. WBUR's senior political reporter Anthony Brooks was also following the press conference, joins us now. Hey there, Anthony.
Hi, Tiziana.
Let me just check in. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for asking. How about you?
I am well, thanks. So let's just start with what stood out to you from the briefing today, Anthony.
Yeah, a couple of things. I mean, I think you put your finger there on the headline, $800 million to sort of stabilize healthcare providers. And the reason that this is needed, as the governor explained, is because these institutions have been asked to do a lot to prepare for this surge, including giving up revenue service sources like non-essential surgeries. So the state's going to be providing $800 million, $400 million to hospitals, which support safety net hospitals on the front line, more than $80 million to nursing facilities, $300 million to other healthcare providers, including ambulance providers, home health agencies, long-term care programs, and the like. So a big source of cash infusion to basically keep the medical system solvent and able to go forward and do what needs to be done during this crisis.
So state tax collection, Anthony, has been delayed till the middle of July, so revenues aren't coming in. Where is this $800 million coming from? Did the governor talk about that at all?
Yeah, he talked about it a little bit. And I have to say that sometimes when I'm listening to this stuff, I kind of lose the thread because state finances tend to be incredibly
I shouldn't laugh, but I'm just that's sympathy coming from me there.
No, I took your laughter only as a positive, sympathetic
yes.
response. But basically, it has to do with a couple of things. One of the things is the state is spending less because these hospitals are doing less of these elective surgeries. So that's my understanding. That's one source of the money. There was another one that the governor explained, but I'm sifting through my notes here and I'm not coming up with it right at the moment.
Yeah, actually, I will admit the part that I understood was essentially the Commonwealth wasn't paying for other kinds of medical services. And that's where this money was coming from.
Oh, there was also a chunk of it coming from the second stimulus package, which essentially a federal stimulus package, which essentially delivers more money to the state and allows them to dip into that pot. So that's a part of it. But the governor also talked about, you know, conversations with members of the legislature. So I'm sure it's a lot more complicated than that.
Let's stay on the stimulus package thing, because he also talked a little bit about unemployment. And you might recall that in a briefing within the last 7 to 10 days, he was very clear that the Commonwealth had not received guidance from the federal government yet about how to distribute unemployment money that was coming down through the CARES Act. Sounds like we're in a little bit different place today. What did you hear on that note?
Yeah, so what I heard, there was a question about unemployment benefits, essentially waiting for those federal guidelines for independent contractors and gig workers who don't end up in the usual sort of unemployment insurance system, as it were. So there's new federal money that states are going to be able to get to pay these contract workers' unemployment benefits, but the state has been waiting for federal guidelines. And you're right, the governor suggested we are in a different place. He's still hopeful that the guidance is coming. He was asked if it would be coming as soon as this week. He said it would. And so that would allow the state to get these checks out to these folks who obviously need the money, having been laid off.
Anthony, there are a number of other really important recurring themes that come up in these daily briefings. One of them is personal protective equipment, and HHS Secretary Mary Lou Sutter's talked some about that today. Governor Baker did too, especially the ventilators, after we got news earlier this week that the Commonwealth thought they were expecting 1,000 ventilators from the federal government and then found out we were going to only get 100. So what's the latest?
Yeah, so the latest is that so it's sort of more of the same, that the state, the Commonwealth continues to have these talks with the federal government every day. Charlie Baker, Governor Baker, said that he believes that the federal government will be amenable to providing more ventilators. He asked for as many as 1,700. And he said, we're going to continue to advocate for more because we think we need them. But he also made the point that one of the ways these ventilators are going to become available are between the states. He talked about the state of Washington sending 400 ventilators to New York City because Washington didn't need them anymore. New York City did. So he expects a fair amount of back and forth as states or sort of regions surge. The surge is going to hit different states, different parts of the country at different times. So that's one of the ways that these ventilators will be freed up. But the bottom line is these conversations with the feds over ventilators coming from the national stockpile are ongoing, and he hopes they bear fruit.
You know, the governor did and does talk a lot about federal cooperation, conversations between states, et cetera. Do you get a sense from him over these last couple of days that the collaboration, clearly with what you just said, there's some good cooperation happening across states. Are we getting a sense of a change in the relationship between the Commonwealth and the federal government in terms of communication and cooperation?
You know, that remains to be seen. It's a great question because, of course, it's a big theme for a lot of governors. And depending on which governor you are, how hard your state is hit, and sort of your disposition toward the Trump administration, I think, determines that. We've heard Charlie Baker express some frustration with working with this federal government, but he's careful about how he expresses that. You know, I'm thinking back to when he was talking frequently about being outbid by the federal government and talking about difficult conversations with the federal government. So I'd be surprised if you got Baker in a private room and said, is everything dandy? You know, is everything sort of, all where it needs to be in terms of the state working out what it needs to work out with the federal government? But Baker's been fairly careful about, you know, how he expresses those concerns. I think, you know, his view from the start of the Trump administration, frankly, is one, you know, for better or for worse, we have to work with the Trump administration. And he's not the kind of guy to get really vocal about these kinds of frustrations. So that's just part of who Charlie Baker is, right? He's kind of steady Eddie. He's unemotive and, you know, just wants to focus on the business and get it done. But, you know, there's no question that there have been some frustrations. And that's what led to this whole, you know, looking for a way to get those 1 million masks from China and going directly to the Chinese government and getting the Kraft family involved in their private jet and so on and so forth, because he wasn't getting what he needed from the federal government.
So there are two other subjects I just want to touch on while we've still got you, Anthony. One, he did give a little bit of an update on testing today. What are the headlines on testing?
Testing, the idea is that testing continues, and they're working aggressively to expand capacity. Massachusetts is now one of the largest testers in the country. There are 25 public and private labs in addition to the state labs. He talked about a new testing site in Lowell coming online that's going to be able to test 1,000 people a day, results almost immediately. And this would be in partnership with the Partners in Health contact tracing group. So some people would get tested, and then they would try to bring those people together with this this rapid testing with the information about how to self-isolate and so on and so forth. He also talked about a drive-through testing site that he had visited in Foxborough that's been up and running for a few days.
So he was also asked about whether he had concerns that this warm weather was going to change behavior in a way that would be detrimental to flattening the curve, Anthony.
Yeah, it's an interesting question because with the warmer weather, you know, people want to get out, and he's absolutely encouraging people to go for a walk if that's what they want to do. But he's trying to make it clear that playing games outdoors, congregating, road races, that kind of stuff just can't happen. And it has to be said that there are some folks in Massachusetts, some elected officials, who continue to be alarmed by this and want Baker to be more forceful in sending out the message that people can't. I mean, you heard him saying that they shouldn't do that, that people shouldn't congregate. There are some elected officials that want the Baker to assert more of his authority to ensure that people don't. But at the moment, you know, he has this stay-at-home advisory, this advisory not to congregate. But, you know, there's the state banning parking at state beaches because they don't like what is happening out at state beaches as the weather gets warmer. So it'll be interesting to see if this sort of soft approach that the governor is using is going to have to change as the warmer weather comes and more people are going to be tempted to go out and, you know, get together on the beaches and so forth.
And Anthony, lastly, before we let you go, we got a sneak preview of some guidelines that the Commonwealth is planning to put out to make grocery store sort of behavior and practices more consistent. It was pretty interesting, the sneak preview that we got.
Yeah, I mean, this is interesting, too, because when you think about these folks who work in the grocery stores, I mean, they're really part of this group of frontline folks who are putting themselves at risk every day to.
We just heard about a Market Basket employee who has passed.
Absolutely.
Away.
So this is an essential part of keeping people safe, not only the people who go into grocery stores, but the people who are working there every single day.
Well, Anthony Brooks, I appreciate you joining us today and on the other days that you've helped us cover the governor's press briefings. I imagine we will do it again. And in the meantime, I appreciate it and stay safe.
You too, Tisha. It's always my pleasure.
Communities of color are being hit hard by COVID-19 across the country in places like Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, Louisiana. African Americans are disproportionately contracting and dying from the disease caused by the coronavirus. Here in Massachusetts, communities with large Black and Latino populations are at risk. Already in Boston, neighborhoods that are largely populated by people of color are seeing more cases than the rest of the city. So today we want to dig into those numbers, and we want to hear from you. What do you make of the alarming rates at which COVID-19 is affecting communities of color? Do you feel more at risk? Do you think that our community's responses to the virus are racially balanced or taking advantage of and making sure that we're addressing pre-existing racial disparities in our healthcare system? Call with your thoughts. Call with your questions. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or tweet us at Radio Boston. Starting with us on the line here is Dr. Joseph Betancourt. He is the Vice President and Chief Equity and Inclusion Officer at Massachusetts General Hospital and has been digging into the numbers. Welcome to Radio Boston, Dr. Betancourt.
Thanks so much for having me. Good afternoon.
How are you?
I'm doing great.
Good.
Hanging in there.
Good. What are we seeing so far in your work, Dr. Betancourt, in terms of how COVID-19 is affecting communities of color locally, state level, nationally?
So let me just say that I think we could have predicted this. We know that natural disasters and disasters of this nature always disproportionately impact minority and vulnerable communities. And I think this one is no exception, but this one is particularly problematic for a series of reasons. And I want to turn us to the attention of science and the science of what we know about the coronavirus. So, you know, the challenging thing about the coronavirus is how easy it's spread. It's spread through droplets, cough, sneeze. It lands on surfaces, could stay on surfaces for 3 days. And people who are asymptomatic could still be shedding virus, could have the coronavirus for up to two weeks. So it's a real perfect storm for rapid spread when people don't even know it. So if you think about what are the factors that would increase that rate of spread, you think about things like areas with high population density. You think about areas and individuals who can't do the types of things that we know from a scientific basis are important to limit spread, like social distancing. So if you think about individuals who live in housing with multiple family members, individuals who didn't have the luxury of working from home and had to take public transportation to work, individuals who are essential workers in places like you've mentioned, supermarkets and other areas where they're exposed to a lot of people. What we know is as those what we call social determinants, socioeconomic status, the environment, housing, all those factors absolutely contribute to disparities that we see already and absolutely are the perfect substrate for the spread of a respiratory infectious disease. And minorities are disproportionately represented among those individuals who live in those conditions and live in lives that prevent them, quite frankly, from being able to do the things that we know many of us can do, who have the luxury of taking our car to work, remote work, you know, living in a home where we can socially isolate in the home. So these are all factors that we see. We see this happening across the country. And so this isn't a black or brown issue. It's more about the social condition and how it disproportionately impacts black and brown people.
So let's talk about what those disproportionate impacts are here in the Commonwealth right now, Dr. Betancourt. You've told WBUR that 35% to 40% of MGH's COVID-19 patients are Latino, up from 9% of the general distribution of the population in the hospital prior to the pandemic. What does that tell you about what's happening outside the hospital?
So if you think about the communities that are particularly in our catchment area, East Boston, Chelsea, Revere, Lynn, many of these communities fit that exact recipe that I mentioned for problems as it relates to this spread. These are communities that are not unlike the Bronx, are not unlike Detroit, they're not unlike Milwaukee. High population density, housing with that's perhaps smaller with more individuals in it, lower socioeconomic status, individuals who need to take public transportation, all those things that I've mentioned. Clearly, our catchment area includes communities with those sets of social conditions. And so, you know, I think the lesson here that we've talked about federally at the state level and locally is that you can never act early enough. And in fact, what we've seen is our inattention to those kind of social conditions very, very early on with a mitigation strategy that is predictive of these hotspots, you know, brings then patients to us who are sick, who require ventilators, that, you know, those social determinants of health come to roost here at our hospital and other hospitals across the country. And that's certainly what we've seen. 35% to 40% of our patients are Latino, and they fit all those characteristics that I mentioned, you know, related to those social conditions.
Let's bring in another voice, and I want to invite callers again, too. If you're listening, are you concerned about racial disparities in how the coronavirus pandemic is spreading? Do you feel safe? Do you have questions? Do you feel like you've got access to the health care and opportunities that you need to be safe? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I want to bring a second voice into our conversation. Michael Curry, a longtime friend of Radio Boston and former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP and currently a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Michael, how are you?
How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Michael, let me begin by just asking you your reactions to what we've heard from Dr. Betancourt so far.
So one, we're lucky to have Dr. Betancourt in Massachusetts, and the work that he's doing at MGH is world-renowned. I travel the country in the NAACP circles, and people know the work that MGH and Dr. Betancourt's been leading for years. So credit to him. And much, I mean, all of what he said is spot on in terms of the conditions that make communities of color more susceptible to worse outcomes, higher mortality, morbidity, mortality rates in circumstances like this. This should not be a surprise to anyone. There have been advocates and activists like the Massachusetts Public Health Association and others, NAACP, local, national, state conference, and many others, Healthcare for All, that have been weighing in for years saying that that we're waiting for a tsunami to happen. And the tsunami is that if we don't take care of these communities that have poverty, that have barriers to health care, that have chronic health conditions, then we end up with our own Katrina. And in this case, this is a public health crisis that if we don't address it immediately, we'll have a disparate outcome for communities of color across this country, and even in our own backyards in Mattapan, Dorchester, Chelsea, and Lawrence. So I think Dr. Betancourt's spot on. I just want to quickly say credit to the governor and the secretary and the announcement they made about dollars. Dollars is a piece of the solution here, is if you put in $800 million, you're giving $50 million to community health centers who have relationships with those communities, who can reach those communities, who can do the community tracing, the contact tracing, who can do the testing, that are on the ground providing the care, then that goes a long way to solving this or addressing this crisis. So credit to the administration, but we need the data. We need to capture the data.
So I'd like to bring a call in here, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. We've got Kai from Dorchester. Kai, how are you?
I'm doing. How about yourself?
Well, that's a good start, Kai. We'll be thinking about you. Do you have a question or a comment for Michael Curry and Dr. Betancourt?
I'm sorry, you cut out for a second.
No problem at all. Do you have a question or a comment for Dr. Betancourt and Michael Curry?
Yes, essentially both. My question is, how do you feel, I guess, this issue should be addressed, or how do you see it playing out as it relates to the lack of believability that Black women just have as it relates to our bodies and what we feel in the moment? How do you think that is going to play out and further exacerbate how it's playing out in the Black and brown communities? And I was just stating that as someone who's experienced this, unfortunately, multiple times, I am a 5-year cancer survivor, and although I was absolutely greatly satisfied with my experience, one thing that stood out to me that just kind of put a damper on the experience was waking up from a hysterectomy and being in excruciating pain and essentially being told that it didn't hurt that bad and that I would have to wait for medication. So I can just only imagine how Black women not being able to literally breathe, or Black and brown women not being able to breathe, how that is going to be, how is that going to affect us?
Kai, I'm glad that you are a survivor, but I am really sorry you had that experience. I think I'd like to turn to Dr. Betancourt first, but obviously both of you, I'd love to invite you to weigh in on Kai's comments.
Yeah, first I want to thank Michael for all his incredible work and for his kind words. I mean, I think this work for us is a passion, and so I appreciate that. And it's these types of partnerships that get things done locally and nationally. A couple of quick things I'd say here: information is paramount, and information to our communities is absolutely critical. And ultimately, given our nation's history of racism, discrimination, segregation, medical experimentation, many communities of color have a long history of mistrust, and as a result, they need individuals who they feel are trustworthy, incredible sources of information, and they need to get culturally competent and high quality and respectful care when they come into our healthcare system. So those are all issues that are critical. And I think part of what we're trying to do, and part of, I'm sure what Michael's trying to do, is to get information out to our communities that is credible, that is actionable, especially in a time of a lot of misinformation, so that people could do the right thing and as best they can. And, the sad part is that there are certain things that we want people to do that we have to realize they just can't do because their circumstance doesn't allow it, like the social distancing and needing to take the train as an example. Well, we need to think about different public health and policy strategies to address those. More trains, perhaps thinking of ways to, if we identify somebody who's positive, giving them housing if they're going to go home and then be at risk of spreading this to people in their home. Thinking of other factors that help us mitigate the impact of this spread in communities of color and communities across the nation.
So, Michael, there's an additional dimension to what Kai is talking about, and I want to invite you to say a little more.
Yeah, so I think it's interesting, and Dr. Betancourt knows this history well. I think most Americans don't, and they should, that African Americans were considered the syphilis soak race. So we talk about the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, but there's a long history dating back to slavery. And you think about just a little over a decade ago, I think almost 20 years ago, just under 20 years ago, the Institute of Medicine put out a report called Unequal Treatment, which validated what many African-Americans and other people of color have been saying for years, that people of color were treated differently in the healthcare system. That's not changed as of today. We've made some progress, but the reality is I don't trust our system to determine who dies and who lives because of implicit bias. And I think what I've heard in conversation with the Attorney General's office just this week with Mara Healy and Secretary Sutters at Health Human Services was experts in this field, Dr. Thea James over at BMC and others say, hey, we need to make sure there's diverse faces, diverse people at the table, LGBTQ, people of color, people with disabilities, to say, hey, that policy is not the right policy. That determination, a surge will impact our communities in a different way, and we need you to put the resources in the right place. The only thing I would say to that woman's comment in addition to that is I have a concern like she does, as Black women do. Are we being tested like other communities? Do we have access to the information that will save our lives and maybe deal with the symptoms, even though we don't have a vaccine, but maybe we'll deal with our fever and help us stay at home? Do we know what contact tracing is, and are we getting the resources to keep our families safe if we do get sick? I'm not sure. Actually, I can say pretty convincingly, we're not getting that. Not in Michigan, in Detroit, in Chicago, in LA, and in New York. And the data is starting to bear that out, that there's inequities about how you access life-saving measures. And we should not be surprised if we looked at our history in this country.
So we kept Kai on the line. And Kai, I just wanted to give you a chance to kind of make a closing remark or response to our panelists.
Sure. So I absolutely appreciate everything that's been stated. But it's reassuring, essentially, the last word, I do apologize. I believe that might be Professor Curry if I'm swapping
Michael
names.
Curry. Michael Curry was your last responder. That's all right. Even I do that sometimes, and I'm the host.
Thank you. Yeah, so absolutely. And as he stated, representation matters, right? So there we know, you know what I mean, just given the fact that Black people have been guinea pigs, essentially. And I was reading, this might be false news, but I was reading that there were they were trying to test out vaccines in Africa. Like, it's just always, we're kind of like the scapegoat and the guinea pig. So I just wonder how all of these great ideas that, you know what I mean, we're engaging in conversation about and all these great remedies, how is that going to play out in a molasses-moving bureaucracy?
Kai, I appreciate that. I will say, just for listeners, we don't have confirmation or any reporting on that last piece that Kai heard, so I don't know if that's real or not. I just wanted to put that out there. It was great to have Kai's call, and I'm going to build one more thing on this, and then, Dr. Betancourt, I'm going to come back to you. Last week on our Week in Review, former State Representative Marie St. Fleur brought up the question of equity and access in this pandemic, and I want to give you a little of what she said.
We're still operating off a system that was built to discriminate against certain segments of people, and we've built systems on that without actually dealing with it. And I think we're going to see that disparity across the country, and even here in Massachusetts. And as much as we work at this, those disparities exist.
So, Dr. Betancourt, do we know, and if so, what do we know about how those kinds of disparities, which have been proven, play out in things like distribution of personal protective equipment or access to testing or speed of testing, et cetera?
You know, it's a great question, and I think what we're trying to do, this is moving so fast that we are, good news is that I think this shines a lot of cracks on issues that we've known exist for a long time, but the opportunity exists that we're making decisions, and I believe I'm trying to fix things that have been broken for a long time, and I hope there will be sustainable fixes. And so a key part of what you're asking is, you know, how are we distributing materials and resources and the like? And the only way we know is if we are able to report and have transparency and accountability. And so I'll just say, for example, here at Partners Healthcare, you know, we are beginning to monitor all of these things, who's coming in by race, ethnicity, by gender, testing. You know, I don't think PPE's been an issue as we think about, you know, our healthcare workforce, but certainly I will say this. You know, a couple of weeks ago, I was having conversations and doing talks for individuals in environmental services, food and nutrition, who aren't able to get information from email, which is our primary fountain of communication, and just talking to them. And you know, a couple of weeks ago, they were asking about masks, and I said, you know, the recommendation is not for a mask, but boy, you know, common sense would say that if you're in a busy train, if you got one, wear it. That's what I'd say. You know, and then 2 or 3 weeks later, now the CDC says everybody should be wearing masks. You know, this feeds into that mistrust, right? That a couple of weeks ago, common common sense would dictate that a mass would make sense. And, you know, it took us 3 weeks to kind of make this recommendation. But, you know, many of the communities we're talking about, they've been on those trains without masks for the better part of 3 weeks now. So the kind of horses left the barn for them. And so what we need to do is build systems to measure these exact things and be able to stratify them by race, ethnicity, zip code, gender, disability, sexual orientation. You know, this is about fairness, about equity. This isn't about some people getting, you know, more than they deserve. I think everybody could agree that what we want to do is make sure that everybody gets exactly what they need.
Michael Curry, one of the things that we're hearing over the last couple of days, it came up in the press conference with Governor Baker today, is the need to and the lack of ability to have solid, reliable data on things like race, gender, I'll just use those two as an example, in our testing and other information. What's going on that it's so hard for us to get that information?
So it's great that you asked that question. So I think our system is set up to collect data. And I remember being part of this conversation many years ago. I was at Blue Cross and Blue Shield, and we convened a meeting with other health plans and the state to talk about collection of data. We're leaps and bounds beyond that. Providers collect data. They report that data into their local public health departments, and DPH has that data. Now, whether the data captures what we need it to is another question. I think what the NAACP president, Tanisha Sullivan, Carlene Pavlos over at Mass Public Health Association and others, they're pushing the Baker administration to say, step up and deliver the data like Michigan, like New York is trying to do over the last few weeks as we see the disparities playing out in New York. We need the data so that we can course correct, so we can figure out if there's places that need a testing site, a drive-up site, that are not getting it. Too many Black families are being told when they call in, I'm sick, I call into the provider, and they say, just stay home, stay sick. We'll presume you have COVID-19. You don't need a test, but they're not getting the advice about how to isolate at home and do those things. So I will say this last piece on community health centers, which is critical to this, as I know Dr. Betancourt would attest to. We can focus all on emergency rooms and hospitals, but that would be naive. And if we want to compare this to a war, that's not a good strategy. The reality is while we protect the hospitals, and provide them with dollars and get them the PPE and prepare for surge, that surge is a spillover throughout our communities. As a former Whittier Street Health Center patient and Roxbury Comprehensive patient, if I can't go to the ER, I'm going right up the street to the health center to get care. And the reality is our health centers don't have the PPE they need, and we've been crying out for the PPE in the communities. We don't have the testing resources. So the money that the governor just announced, along with some federal resources, can really hopefully be pieced together with a state strategy to provide it in Roxbury and Lawrence and Chelsea and parts of the Cape throughout the Commonwealth, where there's inequities playing out because we're not deploying resources. So I say to that, there's an opportunity we have to not relive the Spanish flu in 1918, where Black people in the spring were just sort of left to their own to fend for themselves during the pandemic. We can do something about it now.
So Dr. Joseph Betancourt and Michael Curry, I'd like to ask you to stay with us. I do want to take a quick break. The clock needs us to do that. And then we'll come back and continue this conversation. Still with us is our panel, Dr. Joseph Betancourt, who's Vice President and Chief Equity and Inclusion Officer at Massachusetts General Hospital, and Michael Curry, former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Also you. Are you paying attention to this issue? Is it deeply personal for you? What are you worried about in your community when we see across the country huge racial disparities in those who are getting sick and those who are dying from COVID-19? Call us and share your thoughts. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dr. Betancourt, I want to come back to you for a second. Early on in our conversation, you gave us some statistics from Massachusetts General Hospital that showed a disproportionate percentage of Latino patients with COVID-19 at MGH. We've talked a lot in the last several minutes about the experiences and the historic racial experiences of Black Americans. What do we need to understand about the experiences of Latinos and Latino Americans with COVID-19?
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, I think I just wanted to say I want to double down on what Michael said about, you know, the importance of community-based interventions. By the time people get to us, it's too late. And I think just quickly to say that I think that the data that he's mentioning is critical and necessary at the state level, because we do need to treat this in an aggressive hotspotting way. go to the hotspot, throw everything you can at it, mitigate and prevent spread. So I just want to thank him for raising that.
You know, I want to actually, I'm sorry, I'm going to stop you there for a second. Do we have the ability, the capacity in the Commonwealth to use that strategy right now?
I think we absolutely do.
Okay.
I think we absolutely do. And you know, in fact, at MGH Chelsea, we are working right now with the city and with the leaders there to develop a strategy that can, you know, bring a lot of resources to bear to do things like early testing and expansion of criteria of testing. So we're more readily testing. You know, to Michael's point, we want to give kits to people so that if they're positive, you know, they have a mask, they have a thermometer, they have hand sanitizer, they have wipes, you know, they have a pulse ox so that they could, you know, monitor themselves. And we want to go door to door and provide information, give these kits out to people. And we want to figure out a way to help people who are positive socially isolate. So those are all things that we're thinking of, but we can't do them alone. This needs to be a state and city and a healthcare system and a community-based partnership to get this done. But this absolutely needs to be the approach.
If I could just chime in. So Dr. Betancourt, 100% spot on. The other thing I would add to that, we have a good player in this. In addition to Partners Healthcare and MGH and the leadership there, the state was wise to engage Partners in Health. And I've worked with them since the Haiti relief effort. 3 days after the earthquake, Roxbury rose up, raised a lot of money and a whole bunch of resources, and Partners in Health advised us in that process. They're engaged. They know what it's like to be in countries with pandemics. They know what it's like to be in countries with disasters.
And just to clarify, Michael, they're working with the contact tracing portion of this.
Correct. And they have the governor's ear. They have the secretary's ear. We need to make sure that they have a critical role to play in the whole process because they can advise us. And I know the community health centers, Lowell Community Health Center, Sue Levine and her team that are overwhelmed and stressed and doing it with diminished capacity, with layoffs, furloughs. They're working with the Secretary of State, the administration, to do testing and to do contact tracing out in Lowell. We need to support that effort. The strategy that Dr. Betancourt just laid out is not a new strategy. We just have to lift up voices like Dr. Betancourt and Partners in Health and let them do what they do well.
Dr. Betancourt, just I do have a couple of calls I want to get to, but I'm not sure if you got to both parts of your answer there.
Yeah, I'm happy to take the second part. So look, I mean, I think there's a lot of shared experience between, you know, black and brown people, between African Americans and Latinos here in the U.S., but there are certainly some differences, and I think the couple of the big ones are, you know, a language barrier plays a role here as we try to get people information. Trust is something that's similar, clearly. I think issues around immigration status certainly play a role. I mean, we have a lot of people who are not going to be getting relief checks, right, but who are paying taxes and who are working in restaurants and still out there working. And, you know, if they're not feeling well from a financial standpoint, if they don't go to work, they don't get any money. So you're putting people in a real predicament here. And so, you know, we care deeply about these things as a healthcare system, and we want to focus on these social determinants, but we can't do this in the presence of an eroding social safety net. We need to have, you know, good, thoughtful policy. And so I think there are certainly some differences between Latino communities and African American communities, but I'd like to say that there's a lot of our shared experience here that together allows us to advocate for these social conditions and these social determinants that, by the way, weren't created by chance, and in many instances were created quite deliberately. And I think we need to be careful watchdogs in the future, making sure these policies don't further exacerbate disparities, but also go back and try to fix the things that created these disparities in the first place.
So we have.
If I can add a point on the disparities with Latinx communities that I think is a critical one we should be watching for. Through the third stimulus package, there is $350 million, $350 million. I think it's billion. In that package to distribute to small businesses and nonprofits. It's important that we know what that money is and who it's going to, and critically for the Latino community, whether they're accessing this as small businesses and nonprofits. The language barrier, the cultural, the distrust that sometimes happens with government, you got to be intentional. You got to make money available, be on the scene to make sure communities can access that money. We need their businesses to survive. We need them to have a livelihood and be able to support our economy. And I'm not sure that happened with this money that's being distributed as we speak.
So we only have 2 minutes left, actually a little bit less. We have a caller I wasn't able to bring on air because of time. But Carolyn from Canton had wanted to say, I don't believe this is about race. If you look at the difference, for example, between death rates in Italy and Germany, that doesn't necessarily tell a story about race. What is your response to Carolyn?
Can I read some data for Carolyn, since I think, one, I would love to have Carolyn sit through a public health course that I teach at Suffolk, and I'd love to walk her through history because I think that would dispel that myth. But I want to tell her, in Michigan, the public health department has reported that African Americans make up 33% of all confirmed cases and 41% of the deaths, yet they represent only 14% of the state population. Carolyn, that's proof positive. In Illinois, Black residents account for 30% of the current confirmed cases and 42% of the deaths, but are only 15% of the state population. That's proof. That's the data.
Thanks for that, Michael. And Dr. Betancourt, in our last 30 seconds, I just want to invite you as a doctor in the middle of all of this, what is your message to our listeners today?
You know, our message is that we can get through this. We need to act responsibly. I think we all have, the guidelines and the recommendations in front of us around social distancing, washing our hands, not touching our face, being thoughtful about wiping surfaces and the like. But we need to acknowledge that our neglect of our neighbors, where these are invisible borders, our neglect of these epidemics and their emergence to our neighbors to the north, south, east, and west of us, come to our own peril. They imperil all of us. And so I think we need to address the Chelseas, the Mattapans, the next hotspot, and we need to do it in a way that is thoughtful, that is resource intensive, because at the end of the day, our whole state, and certainly the healthcare providers that I am here with every day who are giving their all to every patient they can, will benefit from that approach.
All right, I'm sorry. I got to say goodbye to both of you now. Thank you so much for your time today. This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering.